This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to Season 7, Episode 25 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we are wrapping up our final series, looking at the current leader of the Star Trek franchise, Justin Lin, and all of his movies that he's directed. It's exciting.
Yeah. It is exciting. He's directed some very exciting movies.
Yes, he has.
Some really exciting movies.
Yeah, it seems to be his thing. He's good at it.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll just look at all 7 of his movies and go through them one by one and see what conclusions we can draw from them.
Let's do it.
All right. His first one was Better Luck Tomorrow, which was an indie movie which he made for next to nothing. Do you want to give a synopsis of that one?
Yes. Several Asian American teens are, you know, going through life, and they are involved in various nefarious schemes. At first, nothing that's too terrible, but then things escalate, and they start to, you know, get a cachet of power and notoriety, and things spiral out of control and go rather poorly by the end.
Yes, they do. So yeah. what did you think about Better Luck Tomorrow?
Great. Especially in the context of like an early or a first movie sort of context, because I believe this is his second actual one, but like the only one it's his first one for practical purposes, right?
Yeah, you can't really get the other one. I think it was so small that it was pretty much, you know,
virtually non-existent.
Yeah, lost to VHS or something. I don't know.
Yeah, but this is especially in the context of somebody just finding his feet and just, you know, moving along. It's really a well done character study, really well cast, well written, good dialogue. The plot is compelling, and at the same time he manages, and you know this is something you wind up seeing through the rest of his stuff. He manages to work in the SoCal background, that environment as a character unto itself, which is really interesting. Cause like I've never lived there. I've visited there once. And so like, I really, you come out of the movie with a feeling of what it was like to live in that area. And so he does a really good job of setting up a sense of place. And I think it's a really good movie, very much worth seeing.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, one of the things which kind of stands out to me, like whenever you see a movie of this scale, you know, especially if it's critically acclaimed, you think like, well, content-wise, it's going to be solid. It has to be. Otherwise, people wouldn't be watching it. But, you know, usually because of the sort of limited resources and stuff and the fact that, you know, I think filmmakers just in general, you know, when they're starting out, they tend to focus on story and character and everything, because those are the important things and they're the hardest things, and you know you need to nail those or else no one's going to care about your movie. But sometimes the visual side of things, the sort of spectacle is lost. And here I was really impressed by how great it looked and you know, mm-hmm. was put together, you know, everything like that. It was really very impressive on that level, which, you know, I think speaks volumes towards him as a director, you know, not just as like a storyteller, but as a filmmaker. And I think that's really cool. Like you look at, you know, let's say Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Steven Soderbergh's first movie, you know,
Soderbergh.
It's a really good movie, but it's very, very restrained, you know, and it's not until a couple movies down the road where he starts getting crazy and becomes the Soderbergh we all know and love, or some of us do.
Yes, well, hey, I got nothing against Soderbergh. I just love teasing you. You know that.
Fair enough.
Everybody knows that. I just like teasing you.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I think that's a fair set. I think that, you know, with Better Luck Tomorrow, you get the sense of somebody who is just starting out, and so you're forgiving certain things and saying, well, you know, it's his first time. Like, you get the sense of somebody who has a full command of, at the very least, the skills that he's going to need to be successful.
Yeah.
And to actually put together a compelling movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. All right. So after the success of Better Luck Tomorrow, Hollywood came calling, and in 2006, he made two movies back-to-back, the first of which was Annapolis,
yes,
starring James Franco and Tyrese Gibson. So you want to tell us what Annapolis is about?
A kid from the wrong side of the tracks, or I guess from the shipbuilding side of the tracks, has dreams of going to the Naval Academy, and he does. And the whole thing is about his struggles of trying to fit in and find his way, because he's always been a maverick, a loner dottie, a rebel. And he instead finds a way to work within the system and gain the respect of those that don't want him there. And along the way, find the affections of the attractive Jordana Brewster as an added bonus.
Yeah, you know, this is a movie which, you know, certainly it is cliche and everything, and, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I would say one of Lynn's lesser works, but it's not nearly as bad as its reputation would lead you to believe. I think it's actually, you know, pretty good. You know, we talked about this on the episode, but it does what it sets out to do very skillfully. It's not going to blow your mind. It's not going to change the way you look at the world or anything like that, but it's a well-made little movie.
Well, and at the very least, there's still the, you know, the skillful construction of character, you know, the characters that he brings to life, or that, I mean, the actors bring them to life, but you can tell that there's a director here who cares about letting the actors work, do their thing, and make these characters worth watching. What's interesting is it is sort of a sophomore slump. Like, if you were to show me these two movies and not tell me which one came first, I would have thought Annapolis came first and then Better Luck Tomorrow came second. You know, like, it's that sort of, it's not a backward step, but it very much feels like something where it's somebody who's less sure of themselves putting this movie together.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they talk about that thing, you know, like in relation to records. Like, I've heard, I think Tom Petty was talking about this, or Jimmy Iovine or something like that, where it's like you look at the sophomore slump in terms of like music you know, that first album is great and the second album is lacking. And the reason is because, you know, you've spent, what, 5-10 years honing those 10 songs or whatever it is on that first album and making them perfect. You spent your entire life basically developing those 10 songs, and then they blow up and they're like, okay, we need 10 more. And you're like, oh, okay, quick, you know, write something down, you know, and then you get that out there. And I think it was Jimmy Iovine who says this on the Tom Petty documentary, Running Down a Dream, which, if you haven't seen it, no one's seen
it. I have. Yeah.
You have seen it?
Of course.
Okay.
I'm a huge Tom Petty fan.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, yeah. I love Tom Petty too, but I get the impression that barely anyone has seen this movie.
No, yeah, I saw it.
If you haven't seen it, it's a 4-hour documentary by Peter Bogdanovich, which basically chronicles the entire career of Tom Petty. And it's extremely worth checking out.
Yes, it
Would
is.
Would you agree? Yeah.
Yes, it's so good. It wasn't a one-night viewing for me. It was split across a couple of nights, but I mean, the depth that it goes into, the, you know, just the insight, the honesty of it is wonderful.
We actually played it. I played it theatrically for one night only, you know, and I don't think anyone coming knew that it was going to be 4 hours long, but yeah, it was great. And I got the running time
in like little tiny print down in the lower right hand corner or something.
Yeah.
By the way, it's 4 hours.
There's an intermission and everything, and it really blew me away. It's so inspirational. Like, just the idea of, you know, creating something. I always love stories like that. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I love Straight Outta Compton so much, you know, this year and everything. But, like, it's the idea of that, but also the idea that it's like, getting together with your friends and creating mm-hmm. something like that. I mean, it's similar to podcasting, you know, and it's really inspirational. But regardless of that, in that documentary, you know, Jimmy Iovine is talking about this stuff and he's like, you know, the first album is great because, you know, you've been working on it forever. The second album tends to suck because you're throwing something together, you know, over the span of like, you know, a week or whatever. But it's the third album where you get the masterpiece. That's the one which stands out and becomes the one that people really remember. And Justin Lin's third album or movie was The Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift.
Yes. The one, the only, the least successful, the one, the deep cut. It's mm-hmm. it's like with the Doors, it's the soft parade. It's how you can tell that's a real hardcore fan is the person that's like the soft parade. Yeah. That's the album to go to. And that's what this movie is.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's Tokyo Drift all about?
The Tokyo Drift ostensibly is about a young lad who loves to race, who runs into trouble yet again and has to go live with his father in Japan. And of course, his love for racing cannot be contained. And so he finds a way to get involved in it again. And along the way, he meets somebody that you may have remembered from Better Luck Tomorrow, Han.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so the movie becomes basically an honor racing movie. You know, like the race at the end is going to decide the fate of all. And, you know, there's tragedy along the way and there's a little bit of love and there's a, you know, an absolutely adorable Yakuza mob boss who truly respects our hero by the end of that movie, even though he cuts off people's fingers for failure.
Hattori Hanzo.
Yeah, he's a charming guy. Yeah. But it's an amazing movie because it absolutely elevates. It takes the concept behind The Fast and the Furious and it turns it into art. It turns it into something that speaks, you know, from like the thing that I couldn't get over the whole time I was watching it was one of the best movies I've ever seen to communicate what it feels like to be a minority to somebody who might not have had that experience. By taking that character and putting him in Tokyo and showing what it's like to be somebody that people don't want to relate to or that treat as an outsider just because of who you are at first glance. Like, it was a really amazing movie in that standpoint. And of course, Han is so cool and so awesome that, you know, like just, you know, Sang Kung is he's amazing. And, you know, yes. Okay. I'm done raving about the movie. Everybody's heard me rave about the movie nonstop. I love the movie. I will always love this movie.
Yeah. And it really does feel like a Lin movie, you know, looking back at, you know, his first two, you know, especially Better Luck Tomorrow, you know, it feels like an extension of that. It's like Better Luck Tomorrow, but in the Fast and Furious, you know, universe, you know, but with racing cars and stuff like that. And that's pretty cool. You know, I like that. It's very much him, even though it is the third film in this franchise. And, you know, it's cool that it's different from what has come before. And it's cool that, you know, it seems like people have recognized his talent, or people did recognize his talent, even though it may not have been the box office success which the studio was hoping for. And that'll come into play in a little bit. But before getting super caught up in the Fast and Furious lifestyle, Justin Lin put a little bit of the brakes on his crazy action filmmaking by returning to the world of indie cinema with Finishing the Game, The Search for a New Bruce Lee, which came out the following year. Yeah. You want to tell people what this thing is?
As we discussed when we talked about it the first time, even though I hate the term, it's a mockumentary about supposedly the never-known-before original plan to finish Bruce Lee's last movie after he died. You know, this is the untold story of what came before what was actually done. And so with that, it's shot, you know, like a documentary, and it follows these Asian American actors as they're going through and they're trying to, you know, step into this role. And along the way, it shows what it meant and what it was like for Asian Americans in Hollywood at the time, you know, that Bruce Lee was big. So while at the same time giving, you know, homage to what Bruce Lee meant culturally to, you know, American society as a whole, global society as a whole, along the way, you learn what it was like to, you know, to see the way Asian Americans were portrayed, you know, in cinema and on television. And this is actually a movie that, like, you know, I was like, yeah, you know, it's good. I get what it's going for. But like, as I've thought about it, as I've chewed on it more, I've liked it more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I've thought about it and thought about it again, coming into, you know, recording this tonight, like, I'm like, wow, you know, I like this a lot more than I thought I did the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good movie. You know, it's definitely a change of pace for him, but I think that he still shows like a mastery of the medium. You know, it's something which you wouldn't normally consider him to be doing, you know, on like an aesthetic level, but at the same time, thematically, it is in keeping with what he's been sort of you know, exploring with his other movies. And yeah, I mean, like you're saying, it does have like some pretty solid social commentary going on, even though it's done very much in a humorous and entertaining way, you know.
Yeah,
it's a lot like Star Trek in that sense, you know.
Right. And it doesn't bludgeon you with the message. It just lets the message play through the material.
Right. And by not, you know, hitting you over the head with it, it kind of lets it seep in, kind of, I think, mm-hmm. you know, in the way that you're describing. And yeah, it's very solid. And to me, like, the thing that stands out about it is the fact that even though it is so different from everything that he's done before, it's still spot on. You know, he realizes that different stories require different storytelling techniques. And, you know, even though he's really, really good at showing cars racing and whatnot, that doesn't mean that he's also not really good at making a mockumentary, you know? And I think that it's pretty good. Ultimately, I think one of his lesser movies, again, but
sure,
still really solid.
Yeah. Well worth it. You know, even though I agree it is a lesser movie, I think it's worth the rental. You know,
yeah.
It's like an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And,
it's
you
like
know,
$3.
Yeah. And like we said when we covered it the first time, it's like the best. And this is a testament to his skill, too, is like, you know, he tells the jokes fast enough that even if the joke doesn't land with you, you know that the next one's coming up and it's going to be rapid fire. It's mm-hmm. going to come up quick. So.
Some really good performances. You have Sung Kang in there again, and it's pretty great. Yeah. Okay. Well, after finishing the game, Justin Lin returned to the world of The Fast and the Furious for three movies. He's been there ever since in terms of his theatrical productions, the first of which in 2009 was Fast and Furious.
Yeah.
You want to give a synopsis of this one?
You know what? I was thinking about this coming into this. There was a movie release that is released on home video very recently that is sort of like this. The Force Awakens. This is The Force Awakens of the Fast and Furious franchise, where it's kind of a reboot, but at the same time, a continuation of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And like, this is, if you miss the first three, this is your entry point.
Man.
And it's really fun because it's essentially rebooting the first movie, like in the fourth one, and it works. It just does. It's fun to watch, and his, you know, even though he definitely expands his use of CG, because that was sort of what Tokyo Drift was known for, the fact that it didn't use CG, that it was using all of this, you know, practical car stunts. He does use more CG, but at the same time, he's, you know, you've got the snidely whiplash villains, and you've got the superhero heroes, who can get shot and just sort of like they get annoyed. You know, like it's really, it's a fun movie, man. It's really worth watching.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, like we were saying before, how, you know, the studio or whoever it was had enough faith in him despite the fact that Tokyo Drift was not a financial success, that they, you know, decided to give him Fast and Furious, which was obviously very important to them because this was their shot at turning this franchise around from a, you know, financial perspective and making it into what it did become. And the idea that, you know, after this substantial, you know, decline with Tokyo Drift, you know, money wise, that they were like, you know what, let's stick with this guy, even though it's going to be very, very different from what he did. His thing was way different from the other two. And, you know, we're trying to recapture the magic of the first one or whatever. The fact that they brought him back to do this, I think, is kind of amazing. It's so not what you would expect a studio to do. And they did it, and it totally paid off. And it really does kind of speak to his talent that he was able to adapt. And even though he was making the fourth movie, he wasn't making Tokyo Drift 2. He was making Fast and Furious, you know, and that's
a prequel, technically.
Yeah, it is a prequel, technically. And, you know, like you're saying, it is a reboot. It's kind of like, you know, you it's like Highlander, where all of the sequels are a sequel to the first movie, you know? they are, like, they completely ignore everything that happened in the other sequels, and they're always a sequel to the first movie.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's like they keep on remaking part two, and this is essentially that, you know? Not that it's negating what happened before, like Highlander does, but it's...
While I respect what you're saying and agree with it, I sincerely wish there was a better movie series than The Highlander that we could use. All I'm
Perhaps. You know, there's some decent Highlander.
The first one, they're all worthless.
Yeah. I mean, two is terrible, right? But, like, The Final Dimension, I thought was solid.
No. It's not.
From the director of November Rain, the music video.
No.
And then Highlander Endgame.
No, that one is also terrible. It is, and I know we have Highlander fans on the Trek FM network, and I love you guys, and I love the first Highlander, both the original American cut and the European cut, as it's called. Absolutely love them, and I even watched the Renegade cut of Highlander 2, but no, that whole series is, after the first one, is awful.
I don't know. I really love the third one, I have to say, but, you know, whatever. Or the fourth one, sorry. The fourth one, the third sequel. I thought
the
that was the
third Endgame.
Endgame, okay. Yeah.
Each their own. As we say on Trek FM, who am I to judge?
When Endgame came out, I found like some message board where the director of Endgame was hanging out, Douglas Arniokoski, and I sent him an email and I'm like, I really liked your movie, and there's three different versions of it on the DVD. Which is your preferred version? Because they said that the DVD was the producer's cut.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what does that mean? And he's like, I don't know, because I haven't seen any of the versions on the DVD or the one that was in theaters.
What?
But my version of the movie starts off like this, and I know that there was a bootleg going around for a while. And I'm like, oh, no, that's on there, because it's got, like, an early cut, which is, like, pulled off of an Avid with, like, no special effects. I'm like, is it this one? And he's like, yeah, that's it. That's mine. And I'm like, excellent. I'll watch that one.
So it's just that I haven't seen the correct of four cuts that are potentially out there.
You need to see the unfinished version. The unfinished version, yes.
Sort of like the 4.5-hour version of David Lynch's Dune.
I guess so. No, because that one is considered to be worse, right?
No.
I know that he doesn't like it, right? He likes the theatrical.
David, who knows what David Lynch likes anymore?
Yeah, he's weird. Whatever.
Yeah. Just don't screw up Twin Peaks. That's the moral of the story. Mm. And Fast and Furious.
Mm. Yes, exactly. Yes. All right. So, well, he didn't screw up Fast and Furious. Well, what did you think about Fast and Furious, the fourth one?
It's a lot of fun. It's no Tokyo Drift, but it's a lot of fun. And I think when I got to it, because, you know, watching all of these in quick succession for the first time, when I got to it, it was number two on the list. But right now, it's I would say that it's, oh gosh, because I haven't seen the seventh one yet. But it's no three and it's no two. Honestly, I have to finally admit that Too Fast, Too Furious is better than Fast and Furious.
All right. I respect that. I agree with it. Yeah, I mean, I do enjoy this movie. I like it a lot more now than I did when I first saw it. And I think part of that is because of, you know, sort of like looking at it in the context of the entire franchise. But I do think that as far as Fast and Furious movies go, there are some better options. For example,
yeah.
Fast Five.
Yes.
So after Fast and Furious's success at, you know, turning around this franchise, I mean, why would you not stick with Justin Lin given the opportunity? And they did. And he was just like, let's make this bigger. Let's bring the whole, you know, everyone together, you know, let's make it, you know, Ocean's 11, Fast and Furious style. Let's make it a reunion movie. And it's pretty epic.
And yes, and they, yes, Brazil is laid low during the hijinks, and The Rock is introduced, which makes anything better.
Mm-hmm.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson I'm trying to think, like, whatever your favorite spice is, like whatever you like to add to something that's, you know, you like, but it's a, you know, it could be just a little bit better. That's what The Rock is.
Yeah.
And that is what he is to this movie. You know, he's pure charisma and lots of fun to watch.
For sure. It's I think, the best of Lin's movies, period. You know, I think that it's Lin's masterpiece in a sense. And yeah. It's so much fun, and it takes the franchise to new heights. And I just love it. I absolutely love it.
Yeah. And to speak to, again, like what we were talking about with Better Luck Tomorrow, like, you know, certain key sequences weren't actually shot in any Brazilian town or any Brazilian city. But the movie does such a good job of seamlessly establishing place that you never question. Like, everything is so, like, There are plenty of movies where when they switch locations and it's supposed to be the same city, you're like, no, that's not the same place. But he does it so well, you know, through that this movie, you never question through the whole thing whether they're right there in Brazil doing what they need to do in Rio. And it's, you know, it's really good.
He definitely ups his game in terms of the action and everything. You know, I mean, you see him learning throughout, well, his entire career, but especially with the Fast and Furious movies, and, you know, sort of honing his craft and becoming, you know, one of the elite action filmmakers, you know, in the world right now. And I think that that's demonstrated even further in some ways in his latest movie, Furious 6.
Yeah.
This was his last Fast and Furious movie. And it's the one which takes place in London, where they need to take down, you know, the evil bad guy who wants
Dracula.
Dracula, who wants to take over the world or whatever. They've come a long way. Yeah, they've come a long way from their TV VCR combos. And what did you think about Furious 6?
I agree with you. It's not quite Fast 5. But the reason for that is that if I were to compare ending chase, battle, however you want to classify it, sequences, more fun at the end of Fast Five, whereas the as well-staged and as wonderful as that plane sequence is on so many different levels, especially technically, it's a little long. It's a little much. And I think that works to its detriment. And, you know, The Rock comes back there, but it's worth seeing. Like, it's very hard to, like, come at it and be like, well, it's not as good as Fast Five, but that's not to say that it's bad.
Yeah.
It's still enjoyable. It's still a Fast and Furious movie, and it's still Justin Lin. It's just that some of the stuff, I'm not offering any, like, special insight into why he left the series or anything like that, but I could very easily see somebody directing this movie after having done, you know, Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift, Fast and Furious, Fast Five, and then Furious Six, and at the end of Furious Six saying, I don't know what else I can give this.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is the maximum. And I've done what I can, and I want to do something new and bow out.
Yeah. And I think that was the right choice. I mean, I remember, like, after he got the job doing Star Trek Beyond, you know, I was looking at Twitter, and, you know, he's on Twitter, and he's like, I'm doing Star Trek Beyond. This is awesome. And, of course, there's somebody on Twitter who's like, I really hope you don't ruin it. You better not ruin this movie, you know, because, you know, it feels like, you know, people are just doing this as like a paycheck, and that would be terrible. And he's like, I'm not planning on ruining it. And he even said, he's like, if I was doing a movie for the money, I would have done Furious 7, because I would have made a lot more money off of that than Star Trek Beyond, you know?
There you go. There you go.
But he wanted to do something different, you know, and I think that that's great, you know, the fact that he, yeah, I mean, he could have done Furious 7 and he would have knocked it out of the park, and instead James Wan did it and he knocked it out of the park. Spoilers for Furious 7. Okay. But, you know, it's like, yeah, Furious 6, it's great. It really is great. But, you know, there is it as good as Fast Five? I don't think so, because I think with Fast Five, they really sort of like cracked the code on these movies and figured out exactly what it was, which made them fantastic. And Furious Six was just sort of like trying to make a bigger version of that. And yeah, it failed in that sense, even though, like, you pull out, you know, like some of those action sequences, like that one at the beginning, and it's, you know, probably the best in the franchise. It just, when you put it all together, it doesn't have like the sort of emotional weight that that Fast Five has. But, you know, Furious Seven, you know, they did something which I think is similar to what they were trying to do in Furious Six, but, you know, they succeeded a bit more. But would I want to see Justin Lin do Furious 7 instead of Star Trek Beyond or any other movie? No, not really.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to see James Wan do Furious 7, because he's been making, you know, Saw movies and stuff like that, and horror movies. And it's like, well, get out of that comfort zone and do something different. And yeah, maybe you'll get something crazy out of it. And, you know, here, you know, Justin Lin's doing the same thing with Star Trek, and I think that that's great, you know?
I agree. I completely agree. And I think that anybody who looks at it and says, oh, this guy did Fast and Furious movies, and so, okay, for as much as it is easy, and this is speaking as somebody who didn't want to get, I never would have watched a Fast and Furious movie if not for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Not like, I wouldn't have gone near it with a 10-foot pole. But what is wonderful about Justin Lin's Fast and Furious movies is they really are, as much as people are going to roll their eyes when they hear the word, they really are about family.
Mm-hmm.
And how family isn't defined by blood, how it's defined by the people that you love and you need around you and that make a real team work. And I mean, honestly, isn't that what the crew of any ship in Star Trek, whether it's called Enterprise or Voyager or Defiant, isn't it all about that family aspect? You know, we're all working together, and we're all in this together, and we will all fight and die for each other. And like, that's really cool, man. And I think that's really going to be something worthwhile to bring to Star Trek, because if anything, you know, the last two Star Trek movies have been very divisive. And I think that if you can knock them for anything, just right off the bat, it's that you feel like that there's this sense of, they're together because they have to be, because this is Star Trek and this is why these characters need to be together. And what I look forward to is Lin bringing infusing them again with the sense of, these are people who are together because it's what drives them. It's what they need. It's how they're completed, is to be around all of these other people.
Yeah, and anyone who's worried about them just being big action extravaganzas without any sort of, you know, heart or story or message or whatever, I think those are people who haven't really seen the Fast and Furious movies. I don't know, for one thing. But also, I think they're people who haven't seen Better Luck Tomorrow or Annapolis, mm-hmm. you know, or mm-hmm. Finishing the Game, or, you know, his television work, which, you know, I know that we've talked about, you know, at times on this show, but to me, it speaks volumes to Lin's talent that, you know, the two television shows which he has directed for, you know, aside from Scorpion, which was, you know, he made the pilot for that, and, you know, whatever, that's, you know, you hire Justin Lin to make a show like that. That's great. Mm-hmm. But the two which were not his shows and by any stretch of the imagination which he came on to were Community and True Detective. You know, what many people consider to be the best comedy on television and the best mm-hmm. drama on television. And the fact that those creators, those people who are known for, you know, producing material at an extremely high standard would trust this guy with their sitcom about, you know, some people going to a community college and their drama about, you know, a group of cops trying to, you know, delve into the darkest depths of humanity, you know, and both of them are like, Justin Lin is the guy to get. And the fact that he did a really good job with both of them, I mean, that just speaks volumes, you know, as far as this guy's talent is concerned. And really, I mean, says to me that there's no reason to think that Star Trek Beyond is going to be bad. I mean, he's made 7 movies here. Not a single one has been bad in my mind. I know that some of them are not loved by everyone, but as far as I'm concerned, every single one of these movies has been good. So the idea that the first time that he's going to make a bad movie, like the one where he's going to drop the ball, is a Star Trek movie written by Simon Pegg, that does not compute. I'm sorry. If Star Trek Beyond ends up sucking, I am going to be shocked. Absolutely shocked.
I agree. And I do think, as much as it might infuriate somebody, like produced by J.J. Abrams, because we went over the movies that Abrams has produced. And if there's one thread there as well, Abrams makes sure his directors get what they need to make the movie that they want to make. And like that's, I think that's important to point out, too, is like people love to rag on the Abrams verse and everything. But as a producer, he's going to make sure that Lin gets everything he needs to make this movie happen right.
Not only that, but I think the other thing that he does as a producer is, which we could, I think, see in his filmography, his producer filmography, which we looked at, you know, a few months ago. He's very good at choosing directors who are suitable for the projects which he's producing. You know, it's not like he has a stable. It's not like he has one guy who he always goes to no matter what. You know, it's not like he's going to give it to his friend or whatever. You know, if his friend doesn't have talent, he's going to give it to the best person for the job, whether that's, you know, Brad Bird for Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, or Roger Mitchell for, you know, Morning Glory, or Justin Lin for Star Trek Beyond. Whatever it is, even when his choices are things which you wouldn't necessarily think mesh well, like Matt Reeves, you know, the co-creator of Felicity for, for Cloverfield. I mean, he's very good at spotting talent and, getting these people to line up with the right projects in order to make good movies. And there's no reason to think that, you know, with Star Trek, he's going to drop the ball on this, you know. I mean, he even made a change. He even, you know, saw something where it was like the obvious choice in a lot of ways, you know, wasn't working. So he course corrected. I mean, is he going to course correct into just another terrible choice? No, I don't think so. I think that this is solid. I think that this is good.
I think it's fair to say that as Star Trek fans, we've seen plenty of questionable choices in the films up to this point. And if I were to go through and tick off all of the different choices that have been made or directors that have been through, Justin Lin is like, he's a great choice. He's a name where I'm like, okay, this is off the bat. This is starting off better than the way it worked out for some other directors along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's a director that has his own vision. He has his own, you know, voice and everything like that, which I think, mm-hmm. you know, especially like during, the 80s and 90s was maybe not as prevalent in the Star Trek movies. I think a lot of them were more producer-driven under Harv Bennett and Rick Berman. And, you know, for a movie to stand out, I think, you know, being director-driven is definitely a plus. And I think it's going to be a plus here, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agree.
So, yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited. That's Justin Lin. Any final thoughts on Justin Lin?
Yeah, he's a really talented guy and a good director, and I can't wait for Star Trek Beyond.
Yeah, you know, up until he was announced as director, the only things that I had seen of his were the Fast and Furious movies, and, you know, the only two that I liked were Fast 5 and Furious 6. But going back and looking at him now and really sort of examining everything, you know, he is a really, really interesting filmmaker, and I'm super excited that he's making a Star Trek movie, you know?
Yep.
And if anyone hasn't seen, especially the Community episode that he directed called Modern Warfare, check it out. It's awesome. It's one of the best half hours of television you'll ever see. And
Need to see Community up to that point to get the episode or to enjoy it?
No. I mean, it's definitely like... There is sort of like the culmination of a storyline, but, you know, if you are aware that these two characters have sort of been circling around a relationship with each other for the past 22 episodes, you'll be able to understand what's going on. And, I mean, the thing that really stands out about it to me is the fact that it is like a big budget John Woo style action movie, only with paint guns. Because it's awesome, okay. But he does such a good job of directing it, and that's what really stands out about that episode. So definitely check it out. It's great. So.
I will check it out.
All right. So before we go, we were just talking about J.J. Abrams producing stuff, right? And just today, as we're recording this, they announced that he's producing something else, and that is a new movie called Colma, which is going to be starring Daisy Ridley, you know, who he found it for Star Wars The Force Awakens, of course. This is a movie which is going to be directed by Marielle Heller, who directed the recent film Diary of a Teenage Girl, which is a little indie movie which was very critically acclaimed. I haven't seen it myself, but I wanted to. Did you see it?
No, I didn't.
Okay. All right. It's supposed to be really good. But again, you know, here you go, where it's like... It's not like he's getting Brad Bird to direct this, you know, he's getting someone, you know. So this movie sounds interesting. It's a remake of an Israeli TV movie, and it's about a woman who, when she's in her 20s, she's like with her fiance or boyfriend or something, and they get into a car accident and he dies. So now 50 years later, she's, you know, an old woman. And she's dying, and she is given the choice. I might be getting this wrong, but she's given the choice between basically going to heaven, you know, and living happily ever after, or going back to that moment of the car accident and, you know, having the opportunity to, like, relive her life, but with her boyfriend surviving or whatever. I don't know.
Wasn't there... a movie Heaven Can Wait?
Yes. People have said this is kind of like Heaven Can Wait. Yeah.
It's no Second Chance TV show with Chandler from Friends.
That's true. It's not. No. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, who knows? Who knows what it is? It sounds weird. It's going to be like, I mean, it sounds like a smallish movie, but really it's not. They say the budget's going to be like 60 to 70 million because it is going to be rather effects heavy, all things considered. And, you know, you got to figure they're probably going to be doing age makeup and stuff like that. But it's a chance for Daisy Ridley to star in, you know, kind of like a vehicle which is outside of the realm of Star Wars, which is cool.
No, you know, I think it's really cool because it's almost like Abrams is looking out for her to be like, okay, I'm going to make sure you're not going to get typecast.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm going to make sure you get something that's not going to lock you into playing Rey for the rest of your life.
Right, exactly. But who knows? We'll see. It could be good. You never know.
It could be. So, yeah.
With Abrams' track record as a producer, it probably will be, you know?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm sure every Star Trek podcast is talking about this week, but, you know, we're going to look at this from maybe a slightly different perspective, but there's obviously a rumor going around. Birth Movies Death is reporting that the new Star Trek series that Brian Fuller is producing is going to take place in the prime timeline in between Star Trek VI and Next Generation, so like after mm-hmm. Star Trek VI, essentially, and that it will be heavily serialized, and the first season is going to be in that timeline, but it could change in season two because the plan is to make it a seasonal anthology, mm-hmm. a la True Detective or, you know, American Horror yeah. Story or whatever. So that's all well and good, you know, and everyone has opinions about that, and everyone has opinions as to whether or not this news is reliable. Devin Faraci, you know, who runs Birth Movies Death and has been doing this for a while, it is you know, pretty solid, you know, for the most part. You know, he's reliable. There are definitely times where he misses the mark, like he's the guy who had published the rumor back when Into Darkness, I think, it just started production, that it was definitely not Khan and that it was going to be someone from the first season, like Gary Mitchell or something like that.
Oh, that's right. Oh, my gosh. I remember that.
Like,
oh,
like maybe it was going to be the Horda or something. Like, it's going to be one of these people from season one. That was not accurate. But then again, I think, I'm not positive, but I think he's also the first person to report the whole thing with the turmoil in terms of the production of Star Trek Beyond and the fact that Orci was not going to be directing, you know, so that, mm-hmm. I mean, just like with any film journalist, you know, he hears things and stuff like that. He seems pretty confident in this. He said that he's gotten 4 confirmations. So I don't know. I'm tending to think that this is accurate, but I'm not 100% convinced.
I would be very happy if it's accurate. Mm-hmm. I'll watch it no matter. It's not like I'm going to be like, you know, if they don't do this, I'm not going to be like, good day, sir, and not watch the show. But, you know, but I honestly, I mean, how to set yourself apart, how to make it something that is compelling, but at the same time offers a promise to fans that, you know, like even if you watch, you know, a season of the show where you're like, yeah, I'm not sure how this is going to go, like, it offers the constant chance of renewal and, you know, freshness. And I think it'd be great if they did it.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I like the time period. I'm disappointed that it's not, you know, theoretically a Excelsior show with Sulu, although who knows, maybe it will be. Maybe it's just
maybe
a different
one
Sulu.
Season it is.
Yeah, and okay, since we're the show about Star Trek creators, let's look at what this means in terms of that, at least to me, you know. This to me seems like it opens up all sorts of interesting possibilities from a creator standpoint. You've got Brian Fuller, who is, you know, running season one at least, right? And I mean, the question that always, you know, came out to me is, it's like, okay, he really wants to do this, obviously, but how long is he going to want to stay and do Star Trek before he gets the urge to do his own thing, you know? And here, he doesn't have to stay, you know? I mean, you've got Nicholas Meyer here, you know, doing his thing, whatever. It's like, okay, Nicholas Meyer is here to do the post-Star Trek VI show, right? The post-Star Trek VI season. You know, what if, since it's only 13 episodes, what if, and it's a supposedly heavily serialized, I'm just assuming it's only 13 episodes. I honestly, it could be 26 episodes again, who knows. But, yeah, you know, looking at, you know, television models and whatnot, who's to say they can't do what they did on True Detective or what they're doing with Mr. Robot or whatever it is and get, like, one filmmaker to come in and direct the entire season? Why not get Nicholas Meyer to direct all 13 episodes? Like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then, okay, it's not like he needs to commit for like 7 years or anything like that, because season, you know, two, you could have someone like Ira Steven Bear come in and do his, you know, theoretical follow-up to Deep Space Nine. You know, let's see where these characters are now, you know, 18 years later or whatever. Why not, you know? And it's not like he needs to commit to anything like that either. He does 13 episodes, you know, then he's gone. You know, you could do all sorts of things like that. You could do the Sulu show, you know.
Well, and find a thread that ties them together. I mean, it's Star Trek. It's science fiction. Like some sort of anomaly, like has you skipping through time, or, you know, almost like a an all good things sort of thing, where like each season there's some sort of piece of a puzzle that goes together. So each season stands on its own, but then it plugs together, you know, later, because somebody picks up something that you see in another season that's, you know, however many years later and stuff like that.
Or you take the model of like what Marvel is doing on Netflix, and it's like, okay, you know, like the plan was like, okay, we're going to do four of these shows, four miniseries, and then have them all come together for like the Defenders or whatever. And instead it's like Daredevil is massive, right? So it's like, okay, well, screw a couple of those. Well, let's just do Daredevil season two instead, right? Well, why can't you do that? If everyone is going to be, you know, like an anthology, you know, kind of thing for like one season, if the Star Trek VI story with all the, or post Star Trek VI story with all the new characters is like super duper great, then why not say, okay, we're going to do that, but then we're also going to do, you know, Ira Steven Bear's Deep Space Nine follow-up, or Manny Koto's Enterprise follow-up, or whatever, or Ron Moore's, like, random Klingon, you know, storyline, or whatever, you know?
I mean, how great would it be? And I, Cloud talking, I'm not gonna get my hopes up, and I'm not gonna, like, you know, walk away from it if it's not this, but how neat would it be if one of the ideas out there was to tell storylines we already knew, but from a different race's perspective.
Yeah.
Like the lead up to Star Trek VI, but from the Klingon perspective.
Yeah.
And, you know, who else better to do that than Nicholas Meyer?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where were the Klingons coming from? And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I can think that. I mean, that would be a really neat sort of thing. Or, you know, like if you're going to have a Deep Space Nine follow-up, like whatever happened to the Jem'Hadar afterward or something, you know, like, they could do some really interesting things with that.
Yeah. And maybe it is a case where Brian Fuller's just like, I've been thinking about doing this for the past, you know, 15 years or whatever, and I have like 25 ideas. So, you know, this is what I'm doing first, and then I'm going to do this. And that could happen. And that's great. That's wonderful, whatever. But I think just sort of the scale of the format, you know, and the idea that it's not a huge multi-year commitment necessarily, mm-hmm. allows for a lot of interesting opportunities in terms of who you get to do these things, you know,
yep.
because a lot of these people are huge names like Brian Fuller. And, you know, if they only need to come in for a year to do this and then leave, I mean, they can do that. That's a lot, you know, easier for someone of that scale to do than you know, committing for an extended period of time. And I think that it would be interesting because you can get numerous perspectives, you can get numerous storylines and everything like that, and it could be pretty great. So we'll see. Obviously, this is all just speculation on our part based on someone else's, you know, rumors or whatever, but
hey, butterfly effect, maybe us putting these thoughts out there, maybe that helps influence things.
Maybe.
So keep talking, everybody. Let us know on the Babel Conference what you think.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to hear. Okay. Because, I mean, like, the first thing that came to mind for me was, you know, like, Ira Steven Bear is, you know, everyone always asks him, like, would you ever want to do a Deep Space Nine movie? And he's always like, yeah, you know, kind of like, why wouldn't I? You know, of course, that would be cool. And then, you know, a few years ago, he was like, if I were to do a Deep Space Nine movie, it would be about Section 31. And it's like, ooh, what would that be? It's like, well, now we could see that. You know, there's that.
Yeah.
You know, everyone always wanting to bring, you know, Enterprise back. You know, I mean, they always talk about it on the Ready Room and stuff. Manny Koto's magic bag of hindsight or whatever it is, where he's been rather open about like what he was going to do in season five. It's like, now you could get that, right? Okay, so there's all these ideas which are out there. You could even extend it to say like, hey, Michael Dorn gets to do his Worf series, you know, why not?
Oh,
right?
Oh, that would be so cool. So, I would be so happy.
So here's our question for listeners, and let us know in the Babel Conference, because we're very curious. What would you want to see? Not just like, I want to see, because everyone's I've been doing this for the past, you know, year now or whatever, you know, or past like 10 years. You know, like, I want to see a movie that takes place in, you know, post-Voyager or whatever. You know, specifically, like, you know who's out there, right?
Yep.
Star Trek creators, non-Star Trek creators, you know, whoever's out there, everyone loves Star Trek, whatever. Who do you want to see do a season of this thing? What are your ideas? What are your specific combos and everything like that? And just because, hey, you know, maybe this is, you know, wishful thinking on our parts, but 6 months ago, if someone would have said, Nicholas Meyer is going to be on the writing staff of this new show.
Right.
I mean, come on. This is the world we're living in now. We're living in a world where Lawrence Kasdan is writing Star Wars movies. Nicholas Meyer is writing Star Trek television shows. The X-Files is back on TV with David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. I mean, it's amazing. The sky's the limit, you know?
Yes.
So let's hear your ideas. All right. Well, it's been fun talking about Justin Lin today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
I want to hear Worf give a command sometime, like 1/4 ramming speed. And then yes. Someone says, Captain, regulation specifically states that we cannot go at 1/4 ramming speed while we are in orbit of a planet.
To the journey! Yeah, where Seven actually mentions that, where she's like, hey, we tried this before. You know, like, I offered my services, and you said no.
You're making her sound like an escort.
I know, I didn't really mean that to happen. It just kind of came out that way.
She's working the alcove.
The ready room.
You know, because he's appealing to the Ferengi side of Nog, which is still so much a part of who he is.
I'm glad he didn't offer him Umox, though.
Yeah, well, whoa. When you said he was going to shack up with Vic earlier, I was like, whoa, it didn't go that far.
The 602 Club. I feel like Men of Steel was a great groundwork to work from, and Batman v Superman, it had to build off of that, because if they didn't build off of Man of Steel, people would say, oh, they're trying to ignore perceived failure in the past. And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or get the RSS link as well. If you want to help us out, you can buy some stuff from our Redbubble store. If you just go to Trek.fm, there's a link to the Trek FM Promenade, where you can get t-shirts, sweatshirts, pillows, bumper stickers, anything you want, within reason.
Yes. Well, yes, within reason, but some really cool designs.
Yeah, and more on the way, for sure. So someone the other day was like, hey, after after December, do we get t-shirts saying that watched 729 episodes in 366 days? I'm like, yep, let's do this.
I think that's a great idea.
Aaron's like, I don't have time. I'm like, you've got 8 months. But yeah, so yeah, keep on checking back, you know, new designs come up, pop up when you least expect it. So
yeah,
All right. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to leave us a review on iTunes, we would greatly appreciate it. That certainly helps us out a great deal in terms of getting exposure and, you know, helping other fans find us and everything like that. So just go to iTunes, leave us a review, and we'll read it on the air. If you do it like in the next 4 days, otherwise you're kind of screwed because we won't be recording any more shows. So
yeah, that's very sad. Come on, man.
Oh well. If you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact. You can leave us a voicemail at speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM, or you can find the network on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum where you can go and talk to us about Star Trek or Justin Lin or who you want to see do a season of the new Star Trek television show or whatever. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, on Twitter, I'm Kessel Junkie. You can also find me co-hosting a podcast called Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And you can find me with Trek FM's own Matthew Rushing co-hosting a Star Wars-focused podcast on the Nerd Party Network called Aggressive Negotiations. And Mike, where can they find you?
You can find me right here on Trek FM, producing From There to Here, our daily rewatch of the entire franchise, where we look at 2 episodes a day for all of 2016. We're well into Next Generation at this point. And yeah, it's exciting. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. And that's about it for now. All right. So yeah, that takes care of Justin Lin. Very exciting. You know, we started this whole thing with Gene Roddenberry, and who was the first Star Trek creator, and we're ending it with Justin Lin, the most recent Star Trek creator, or the current Star Trek creator, maybe not the most recent, but the current Star Trek creator. And yeah, next week we're going to finish up this whole podcast commentary.
An extravaganza, if you will, Mike.
Yeah, we're going to put a bow on it and discuss everything that we learned, how we got here, everything that we learned. Maybe our favorites, our favorite creators, our favorite shows, whatever, you know? You'll just have to tune in. It's going to be our all good things. So
yeah, I like that, yeah.
Yeah, so be sure to check it out. You know, one last episode.
It will be our all good things and not our These Are the Voyages, I hope.
We shall see.